How I Did It, the Business Post Women in Leadership podcast with Nadine O'Regan.
Sponsored by Glamdoor, creating space for business to grow.
Hello and welcome to the brand new season of How I Did It, the Business Post Women in Leadership podcast with myself, Nadine O'Regan, and sponsored by Glamdoor. How I Did It is the podcast series where we talk about leadership through talking to some great female leaders. In this new season, we'll be speaking to well-known names in academia, business, entrepreneurship, politics, and the arts. We'll also have advice and tips for you from experts in areas such as public speaking, CV preparation, and career advancement. A little bit later on in this episode, I'll be joined by Lorraine Murphy, an executive coach who'll be discussing networking and how to put your best foot forward, even and perhaps especially when it's very difficult to do so. Now, though, to our first guests in the new season. I'm delighted to tell you that our first guests are two women who have forged exceptional careers in academia in Ireland, Linda Doyle and Mary McAuliffe. Linda Doyle is the provost of Trinity College, Dublin, and the first woman to hold that position since the founding of the college in 1592. She was previously professor of engineering and the arts in the university. From Cork originally, in the last decade, Doyle has raised over 70 million euro in research funding, as well as being a widely published scholar in her field. She has also been a leading advocate for women in STEM. Mary McAuliffe is a historian at University College Dublin, where she's director of the Gender Studies programme. A former president of the Women's History Association of Ireland, McAuliffe is an expert in Irish social and revolutionary history, as well as histories of gendered and sexual violence. An author and well-known contributor to the media, she received her PhD from Trinity and is on the executive committee of the UCD Centre for Gender, Feminism and Sexualities. In the podcast you're about to hear, we talk about ambition, about leadership, about personal sacrifice, about the joy and sometimes curse of social media, and much more. If you're listening to the podcast and you'd like to discuss it online, you can use the hashtag HowIDidIt on Twitter. Or if you'd like to get in touch, you can do so also on Twitter via @NadineO'Regan. I really enjoyed talking to Linda and Mary. They had great stories to share and they gave me a lot of food for thought. I hope you'll enjoy listening to the podcast too. So without further ado, here is Linda Doyle's and Mary McAuliffe's How I Did It.
How I Did It, the Business Post Women in Leadership podcast.
Sponsored by Glamdoor, creating space for business to grow.
Linda and Mary, you're both very welcome to the podcast.
Thanks a million.
You've both been in higher education for many years at the very highest levels. But perhaps we could begin by hearing a little bit about your beginnings and your past and what made you want to get into academia in the first place. Linda, I believe you came from a family of printmakers in Cork.
Yes, I did. And in one sense, the fact that my family hadn't been in university was exactly what helped me forge my way. So I've told the story a bit, but I found engineering for myself when I went to an open day in UCC. And I was sitting there and somebody started talking about electrical engineering. And I said to myself, whatever that is, that sounds great. I'd like to do that. And it actually was as simple as that.
At the time, it was such a rare occupation or subject for a woman to take on.
But you see, the thing is, really, I actually didn't think about it like that. And I think in a way, oftentimes we kind of put things into boxes and have certain sets of expectations. And my family, I remember when I said to Mum, oh, I think I'll do engineering. She said, oh, that's lovely. What's that? You know, so I think in a way that was really empowering. And, I didn't have any preconceived notions. It was only when I got in there I saw that. But absolutely, I didn't think about it at the time. And, wasn't something I thought, oh, that's not for me. I thought, that's really interesting. I'll give it a go.
Well, similar to myself, you got your first degree in UCC and then moved for your master's to Trinity College Dublin. What was that like?
So it was interesting. I'd taken a year in industry in between. Industry can be really, really rewarding. But I knew instantly, I actually literally knew the second I was in there that I was in the wrong place for me. And I'd really yearn and draw to want to get back. And I love the ideas of teaching and research. And I really, really wanted to get back. So I began looking for an opportunity. So then I got the opportunity to go and study in Trinity. Though I did actually, the very first day I went in to meet somebody about that opportunity, and I've said this a few times too, that I remember sitting on the steps of the exam hall, the public theatre, and thinking, I'm never going to fit in here, which I can remember very vividly still.
Yeah.
But obviously, I did find my way there and very much love it, I have to say.
Yeah, well, sometimes that outsider mentality can be very helpful. Mary, obviously, you're steeped in UCD, but your first degree, your master's and your PhD was actually from Trinity.
Yes, it was, yeah.
And what was the inspiration for you to continue on that track through academia?
Well, I suppose, like Linda, going back to my origins, in my family, you either go into education or engineering. So there are two sides to the family. Either there's a whole load of engineers or there's a whole load of people in teaching at primary, secondary and third level. And that seemed to be the trajectory. And actually, for many years, I kind of rejected that. And I was looking back at my diaries, because I've kept one since I was about 12, yeah, inspired by the Diary of Anne Frank when I read it, you know.
Didn't everyone try for a diary for a while?
But I've kept it on. And I saw, I'm going to go to Trinity. And I actually thought, I think I didn't know that there were other universities at the time, because, of course, my uncle was in Trinity, and he was my godfather, and I was going to go there, and that was it. So going to university was something that was in the family. Becoming an academic was something that came later as I went through doing my degree. I wasn't sure. I didn't know. I knew I didn't want to be a primary school teacher or a secondary school teacher, but I didn't know I wanted to be an academic until I'd say I started my master's and then on into the PhD. And then I discovered, actually, this is where I want to be. I did have some time, you know, when I finished my PhD out before, you know, doing occasional lecturing before I got a full-time job, as happens many academics, that I was working with exhibition companies doing research. So it was sort of in that business. And that was really interesting. But like yourself, it wasn't really space for me. I wanted to be back in education. I love lecturing. I love doing research. I love writing. Not so much the administrative part, but, you know, you have to do that as well.
And did you find that academia was a welcoming place for a woman of your age in that time?
It's not a straightforward answer. I think because I was doing gender history at a time when it was becoming established as a discipline within history, there was a lot of pushback against that.
And, in what way?
You know, I remember one colleague saying to me, oh, are you still doing that gender history, very much a marginal type of history? You know, go back into doing real history, political or military or the mainstream histories. And also I was working within gender studies rather than in a history department. So that there was pushback, and you had to fight to get your platform, and you had to fight to get women's history accepted, and gender history is seen as a valid, a really important part of the broad historical narratives and methodologies that were out there. So there has been that struggle, and it's not just been me. That struggle has been going on really since the advent of second wave feminism, and over 40, 50 years of gender history, we're still shouting about, say, in this decade of centenaries of getting women's history on those platforms and the experiences and contributions during the revolutionary period. We had to battle to get that.
It is remarkable, the invisibility of women through history.
Well, it's changing and transforming, and more people are interested and they want that. There is still resistance because, again, you know, the valid nature of women's lives is always questioned. The idea that women did anything other than stay in the home and bring up children for the next generation is seen as that's what we just have to talk about. So just do a bit of social history and then you're fine. Whereas I do, you know, gendered violence during the revolutionary period. And again, somebody said to me once, why would you talk about that? That's you know, we don't need to know about that. But you look at today, war happens. Women's bodies are often the battleground on which wars are fought, even in peacetime. So I think it is a vital contribution to our knowledge of who we are, where we've come from, how women's lives have been shaped by these forces. And without it, we're not telling the full historical story.
Very true. Well, Linda, we've both assumed leadership in your respective roles. Linda, your last year, let's say, mm-hmm. has been something else. Yeah. In August, you became Provost of Trinity, having taken up the position for a 10-year term. How does that feel? And were you always ambitious for that?
So, I mean, I have to say, I absolutely love the job and I'm still pinching myself. So it feels amazing and it feels a great honour. And with the ambition question, I think it's interesting. I'm a kind of person who actually likes being outside my comfort zone. And I think one of the great things about academia, actually, is there's always something new you can do. So you're kind of never doing the same year and year. There's always a new project, a new idea, a new thought, new network, new things to do. So from that perspective, I was always eager to do that. And I suppose I'm good at putting my hand up and saying, I'll give that a go. So I had some kind of good opportunities. Like, for example, I got to lead a national research centre, a Science Foundation Ireland research centre called Connect. And I've always been a good person to say, yeah, I'll try that. And actually, I think women can be very good at leading large scale entities that are complex, that are multidisciplinary, and that require, I suppose, a kind of joining of the dots and a kind of thinking big. And I think I kind of recognise that. And through then saying, look, I'd like to try that, it kind of put me on a path that led me to where I am here. So, yeah, you could say I was always ambitious and curious and wanting to move beyond that kind of, you know, comfort zone.
Is ambition a word that you're comfortable with and that you think women are comfortable with generally? Because at least in my experience over the decades, the way we react to that word has changed.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people aren't comfortable with this. So I am. I remember a number of years ago, a friend of mine in gender studies in Trinity, Marianne Valulis, had a conference on women and ambition. And you had to have a conference on women and ambition because it was a thing to talk about. And it was one of those words that kind of jarred. And I find it annoying, very annoying. I mean, I think it's okay to be ambitious and I think it's okay not to be ambitious. And you can also be ambitious in so many different ways. So ambition is not always about, you know, running the world. You can be ambitious in and it can have such a range of flavours. But it should be a word that nobody should be afraid to use, I think.
Yeah. And what about yourself, Mary? Is ambition a word that's very much part of your vocabulary?
It wasn't, but I would say it is now, and in the way you describe, Linda, in that I'm ambitious in many ways for the profession I'm in, for the specific discipline of gender history, to get that on a platform that is heard and is amplified by both male and female historians. I'm ambitious for myself as well, and it has taken me a long time to realise that, yeah, I have ambition. I do want to succeed. I do want to, you know, run research projects that I have ideas about. And, you know, I'm developing, percolating one in my head at the moment that I hope to go for funding for. And I think that's part of ambition. But women do have a conflicted relationship with ambition because we were always thought in many ways that ambition was a male thing. That, you know, an ambitious woman was pushy, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's very true.
You know, all that sort of thing, a bit of a bitch, really, you know, those horrible words would be used. But I think we can, and that, I was at that conference, actually, Women and Ambition, and I think it's something we really have to think about. Because, yeah, you can be ambitious, but you can be ambitious without, you know, wanting to dominate the world or wanting to push other people down or make a space for yourself and exclude others. You can be ambitious to bring everybody along with you and to be inclusive and to promote marginalised communities, for example, or to do good things in the world. And I think ambition is something that women really need to think about and become more comfortable with, because it's not a bad thing.
I think also this kind of comes to around to what does leadership look like. And one of the things I find that people associate leadership, and especially strong leadership, with a particular style. And if you have a style that isn't combative, that's collaborative and that's inclusive, you often get asked questions, oh, will you be able to take hard decisions? Are you too soft? And that drives me, I have to say, absolutely crazy, because I think you can take really strong, really difficult, really complex decisions in a really informed way, you know, by drawing on a certain style of leadership. Mm. And to me, they're kind of connected, those questions, what you were just saying, Mary.
I 100% agree in principle, but in practice, can you give me an example of how that works?
Do you mean in making a hard decision?
So like if you're able to be collaborative and work well, and then the question comes up, would you be too soft? Sometimes people say that the best route to solving that particular problem is to go particularly hard on one.
No, I think you have to remain true to yourself and true to the question. And so, you know, we talk about diversity a lot. And what diversity means is that when you have a let's face it, most of the decisions you have to make are not black and white. They tend to be complex with many different angles. So you make the most informed decision when you create a set of diverse voices that can feed into it. It doesn't mean that everyone has to agree and that we're all kind of throwing beanbags around and it's all, you know, and yes. You know, so it's it means that you're informed when you make that decision and you've taken those different things into account and you weigh them up. And I don't think you have to do a one kind of, you know, I have to come into this meeting and I have to really exert myself. So suddenly they'll take
me
seriously.
Hang someone outside the window as an example to everyone else.
Yeah, no. I think we recognise that as a form of leadership that stems from patriarchal, hierarchical
systems. I agree completely.
Systems, you know, that lead to things like authoritarianism, where one hard man at the top makes all the tough decisions. I think we've had more than enough of that in the world, actually.
Is there one thing you wish you'd known as a very young woman entering academia?
Confidence. Your voice is important. That, you know, speaking up is something that is valid, that what you have to say should be respected, that you shouldn't be shut down. I mean, even at this stage of my life, attempts are made to shut me down on public platforms and trolling on social media and all that sort of thing. But I have the confidence to overcome it now. But I remember, like, in my first maybe year or so as an undergraduate, I rarely spoke up in class. And I even see that today with students in my classes, the majority of whom would be women, less so now. The young women are much more confident than I was at that age. So I wish I'd had more confidence at a younger age, but the confidence did come in time.
Well, you mentioned occasionally being shut down even now, and I don't want to dwell on it too much, but recently you were the victim of Zoom trolling. Can you tell us a bit about that?
I won't go into the details of it because it was particularly vile, but it was Zoom bombing, and I was giving a talk about male violence in the historical context in the War of Independence, and it was a deliberate targeted attack to shut that down. And I think that is very common. These Zoom bombers target women, they target LGBT communities, they target people of colour, anybody who is, you know, from outside of the mainstream, from outside of the centre of power, the male centre of power. They target those meetings and with vile pornography and misogyny and racist comments and shut them down, basically. So it's about denying of platforms again. And I mean, it's ever been thus in a patriarchal system.
Yeah.
And I think we need to talk more and more about how we still live in a patriarchy. You know?
Well, sometimes it's very difficult to apply the controls outwards in a situation like that. You're at the mercy, in a way, of systems like Zoom or Twitter.
Yeah, yeah.
Which can be very difficult to engage with, to get the reaction that you would like from those tech services. But obviously, one thing we can control is our own responses and how we deal with stress, wherever it's coming from. Linda, you know, what would your particular stresses be in academia, and how would you deal with them?
There's different stresses in academia for different people. And I think a lot of the time the stress is that the job is never, there's no beginning, middle and end of your day. And that to me kind of dominates a huge portion of the challenges around academia. Now, that's the case now as well. And I live on the job, which adds to it.
You live on campus.
Yes, I do. Yeah. So
this is a recent development.
Yeah, yeah. So you as when you become provost, you get to live on campus. So so you're 24/7 there. So the way I mean, I think I think the big stress is always is you doubt yourself, you worry that you've made the right decision. I mean, we're all familiar with the imposter syndrome type scenario. This never goes away, that you think, oh my God, I fooled everyone into electing me into this position. So you have days like that, but you also just have stresses because you can see yourself, students and colleagues around you, terrible things happen. You can also see yourself just the pressures of making sure that you're kind of delivering the best you can for the university. And, you know, Trinity's been there for a long, long time and you want to make sure that you leave it in a better place than you got it. So you have that kind of those kind of stresses. But overall, I mean, there are two things for me that help. So first of all, I work with a wonderful team of people and I always find that, if anything is really complicated or difficult, once you can kind of work with people, you can laugh, you can work through the problems, that works. But the second thing that I find increasingly good, I have developed a way to be in the moment. So I can go from a very complex, we'll say, difficult meeting where things are very hard to deal with and perhaps maybe have to go to a student event afterwards that can be just very enjoyable. And I'm able to, switch off and stop thinking about that and just enjoy the event I'm at and then move on to the next thing. And I've kind of developed that skill and I find that very helpful for dealing with things.
So compartmentalization, really?
I think that's one way of putting it. I mean, I heard some people talk about it in a more mindfulness way. Now, I've never practiced mindfulness, but it is just about kind of saying, okay, that really big issue is not going to go away, but me worrying about it for the next hour is also not going to solve it. So I'm going to be here and kind of be present for this event or for these people or whatever. And I find that helps an awful lot, actually, I have to say. And also completely forgetting about everything then when you go home in the evening.
You go home on campus.
Yeah, when I go home on campus.
And are you a social media user?
I am, but not extremely. So, yes, I am. I mean, I'm on Twitter and, but I have to say as well, I think another technique is you just kind of can't read some stuff. And
yeah.
There's nothing you'll say that some people won't like and some people will think is okay. And in fact, actually, I find as well, when I don't say something, sometimes it can be an issue. So you can't over-scrutinise responses that people have.
Just to your point about presenteeism, sometimes social media usage can be the thing that actually divorces you from reality.
Yes. Yeah. That's true, actually, because there are times when I'm at an event and somebody will say, make sure we get a photograph and we tweet and we do this, and you're kind of concentrating on that rather than being there. And of course, you want to do that too. You want to recognise the great things that happen, but you are right. It's like I always laugh at tourists who go taking photographs of something and they spend all their time taking photographs rather than being there looking at the thing. So it's kind of like that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And Mary, similarly, we've talked a little bit a particular stress that you encountered recently, but more generally, what are the stresses that you would encounter?
Well, I think academia is, as you said, Linda, it's a 24/7 job in many ways, There isn't. You go in at 9 and you clock out at 5. My day can run from 8 in the morning to 8 or 9 in the evening if you have public lectures and things like that. And I sit on many committees as part of my role as the Director of Gender Studies. And so they bring all those stresses with it. I de-stress at home.
Are you good at switching off?
I am good at switching off, although I find I need to try and control the social media a little bit.
So are you watching the TV with a laptop, with a
phone? Yeah, responding to, if I'm watching RTE Primetime or something like that, I'm going, oh my God, what are they doing here?
Yeah.
And things like that. Although sometimes I enjoy that. I remember 2016, they had a television series on the 1916 Rising. And I was doing commentary on it because I found some aspects of it very funny. And people were following me then doing the commentary. And actually, I really enjoyed that. It was it felt like a break from the seriousness of that particular period and that particular part of the decade of centenaries. But the way I find to switch off, which is kind of nerdy, is that if I'm under stress at work, I will take an hour off and I will go and start reading my research and making notes to myself, and because I love that.
Isn't that lovely?
Side of it.
Though I'm sure loads of people wouldn't call that switching off, Mary.
No, I suppose not.
But the fact that you enjoy it is amazing.
That's so great.
And the other thing I really like doing is watching dystopian fiction and apocalyptic fiction. I love zombies and The Walking Dead. And if I, really need to switch off, I just go into the room with the Netflix or the whatever channel and watch zombies. And it's weird, but
now,
I enjoy it.
Aside from watching zombies, what advice would you give to, say, newer colleagues who are entering the arena about how to cope well with their job?
Don't let it overwhelm you. And I mean, it's very difficult not to in academia to let it overwhelm you, because you have students, and students are great, but you know, they are under huge stresses as well. So you have to be there for them, not just academically, but also, you know, as a person that they are coming to for support in all sorts of ways. There's an awful lot of administration now that devolves on the individual academic that perhaps wasn't there before, that you do have to get through, as well as doing all your teaching and your research and publishing. That is part of the role as well. So it can become overwhelming. And plus, now I don't know if I'd like to be starting out as an academic now, because there can be years of precarity.
It's such a tough career path.
It's a very tough career path, and there aren't clear ways to a full-time job in the same way there used to be. So you probably go through, you know, occasional lecturing years, temporary contracts, all that sort of thing. And it can be a good decade into your career before you might get a job, if you're lucky. And there's a large part of luck involved in getting the full-time job now.
And you kind of have to be good at everything. You know, when I started, you know, you it was your kind of teaching and your research. Now you have to be a good public speaker. You need to have an international profile. You need to be able to do education and outreach.
Bring in money.
You need to bring in funding. You need to, you know, you need to be able to be on radio shows.
You need to be able to
do everything. And I think I often sit on, you know, when I used to sit on interview panels, I think thanks be to God I've got a job now, because I think it is much harder. And Mary is right, there's kind of a longer route into it. You can be, if you start, we'll say, at a typical, just coming out of college age into research and your PhD, you can actually be quite
well into your 30s before you actually. So I think you have to develop methods of switching off, of like shutting, because your brain needs a rest from all of that.
The
as
inner
well.
Voice in your head
and
is
shutting off
a
the inner voice. And particularly for women, then the imposter syndrome is very much part of that. You know, am I good enough? And still, women academics have to be nearly twice as good as the male academics in order to get as far.
Do you really believe that?
I still think it's the case. In large part, it's changing, but you know, all of these transformations take time. Cultural shifts are the hardest things to happen. You can put in all the equality legislation and EDI protocols in place, but the cultural shift takes a longer time to impact on systems, because of course the universities have been around for a very, very long time.
One of the things that I have found very helpful in recent years is the constant calling attention of subconscious bias. So saying to people ahead of appointing somebody, or ahead of even getting panelists in on a radio show or a TV show, hey, let's just make sure there's a gender balance on this panel. Let's make sure that if we have six speakers on the stage, that a minimum of two are female, so that the audience doesn't walk in and get confronted, as has often been the case, with six men's in suits. So the manals, exactly. Yes. And it's often not that there's any bad will on the part of any of the producers or people who are selecting for those panels. It's simply that it's not a factor that they've put into their spreadsheet as something they need to consider. So sometimes just constantly calling attention to it and saying, look, have you considered this? And I've found it very inspirational to see that on a number of occasions, you know, men with a big profile have stepped down and said, I won't take part in a manel. So, you know,
that's great.
Yeah. So the men need to, I think, be allies as well.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, so you'll find now in most institutions, in Trinity and others, that, you know, there is no such thing as having an interview panel that isn't balanced. Mm. There, you know, so that kind of stuff has dramatically changed. You'll also see on the research front that there can be increasing carrots as well as sticks in terms of, so, you know, there'll be particular initiatives that will encourage women, or there'll be particular quotas. And all of this actually, even though, as Mary said, culture change takes a long time, all of this is kind of helping. So basically, when people realise there is no other option to do it this way, I think it really pushes things forward. And then there's things, I don't know whether you're familiar with the Athena Swan programme, but this is an initiative that all universities participate in, and it's about actually analysing where you are in terms of gender equality, and now increasingly moving to wider kind of understanding of diversity and inclusion, and kind of reflecting on that, understanding where you are, and then taking action to address it. So all of those things help push things along, and I do actually think, actually, in a lot of things I go to these days, it would be unacceptable that there would be a male only panel, you know, and I think men would find that unacceptable as well as women. Now, you can live in a bubble of a certain world, but I think it's you know, in work, in a day-to-day basis, that has become the norm.
Mm. It is changing. There's no doubt about that. Very slowly, but it is changing. Mm-hmm. And that can only be for the better. And it is not, as you said, the Athena Swan is not just about gender anymore. It's about, you know, race and ability, disability, class, all of those things. And that will only, that'll diversify the university eventually. But I think that brings in such a broader set of skills. All of those people that perhaps were missed in previous generations that would have been brilliant academics or contributors or researchers, they should be coming on board now. But we still have a culture of mostly middle class kids going to universities. We need to broaden out that and change that and transform that.
And in certain professions as well. Journalism is a good example of a very middle class profession. Because people in their 20s who are working in journalism would often need support from their families.
This is a problem.
It's actually a precarious existence.
That's why we have actually some access programs in Trinity called Pathways to Law and Pathways to Business, and it's a direct recognition that certain professions are very, very difficult to break into. So it's not just about making sure people get access to the university, is that in accessing the university, that any profession or our pathway should be open to them, as distinct from, you know, you just only being able to do a certain set of subjects because of your, you know, of where you come from. So I think that's really important.
I think the universities do that. Like in gender studies, we do outreach programs where we do certificates and diplomas in social justice and women's studies with communities in places like Clondalkin and Crumlin and various other places with local community groups and women in those local community groups who perhaps left education early and want to come back in. So we do, they get a UCD certificate or a UCD diploma, and then there are pathways on from those into the university. Mm-hmm. And loads of them have gone on through that. And we did a study a couple of years ago on, we'd been in it about 10 years at that stage, and the majority of our graduates had either gone on to university or gone into employment.
It's amazing to see how that world can be, the world can be reshaped just with a bit of imagination. But I mean, for you personally, Mary, you're obviously a really, really hard worker. Have you made personal sacrifices to get to where you are now?
That's kind of a hard one, because I love what I do. So I don't see it as a sacrifice. I suppose, I mean, if I'd gone into business, I'd be much wealthier than I am. I mean, I have the privilege of having a secure, relatively well-paid job. If I'd been the part of the family that went into engineering, maybe I'd be earning much more. But I don't know if I've made huge sacrifices, because this is what I wanted to do. I don't see it as a sacrifice. So
you have the look where the work is its own reward.
The work is its own reward. I suppose the sacrifice is I do get trolled, I do get attacked for the type of work I do. And as a feminist and as a LGBT person, yes, I have been attacked. And you know, being out about that, being a feminist since I read Simone de Beauvoir at 19, in my first, you know, years in Trinity, you know, you if you're going to be very open about who you are and what your politics are and who you are yourself, particularly if you're part of the non-mainstream of a marginalised community, you will get attacked. And there's no doubt about that. And I suppose you could see that as a sacrifice, but actually I see it as a privilege, as something that I have a platform, and I will use that platform to promote feminism, to promote LGBT rights, to promote anybody, any of those communities I feel need amplification from my platform. So I don't see sacrifice really as part of my life in many ways like that, in that sense.
Has there ever been a moment when you did feel like packing it all in, though?
Not really, no. Because I love what I do, but also I don't really know what else I could do. At this stage, I don't think I'm qualified to do anything else. This is it.
Well, Linda, what about yourself? Have there been many sacrifices?
I don't think so either. I mean, maybe this is a feature of working in academia. I kind of think most of the time you don't work there accidentally, and it is driven by, you know, it is driven by kind of passion. It's one, and I absolutely 100% agree. It's a privilege. So no, I feel very much that I've been very lucky.
You've never been there with the resignation letter
ready
to put on the desk.
No, not for 1 second.
See you later.
No. I might say it like, I'll see you later tomorrow. I'm out here today. Yeah. This is it. This is enough for today, but that's about it.
Why do you feel? Did you ever feel that? Are you allowed to say that in the podcast?
I think we'll leave that in the podcast. I think, you know, coming to that idea, though, that sometimes those challenges, it's about how you react to them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one great piece of advice I got from somebody is, if you're presented with a problem and it seems insurmountable, the answer isn't to hand in the P45. Mm-hmm. The answer is to theorize the solution and then present that endlessly. Mm-hmm. So if that is a route, that is a route that, you know, that to live by, I think that would be the route I would go. You know, when presented with massive challenges, the answer is to go, well, if I were in the situation where I could change it, what would I do? And that's very helpful, I think, to people around you, because you're sort of saying, well, this is the nature of it, this is the challenge, and this is my area of expertise, so this is what I would do. And I guess one thing that, you know, going back to the idea of things you wish you'd known earlier, I would sometimes wish that I'd known, you know, just from a mentoring perspective, those kind of details earlier. Because I think when we start in our jobs, we do what we're asked to do, and sometimes not beyond that. Yeah. So sometimes it's about thinking beyond the immediate challenges of the day-to-day existence to say, well, look, if I was looking at this in a more holistic way, in a rounder way, what would the answer be? Yeah. So, you know, but I have three older sisters, so I've learned a lot from them.
Yes, that's always good.
Actually, one question that came up, and I don't know if you have an answer to this immediately, but is there something that most people wouldn't know about you that would surprise people if they did know?
I don't know. I think most people know I'm from Kerry. That's a very important thing. Sorry, Cork, Kerry, or Ivory.
Obviously, Cork is more important.
Two Cork people here.
My father won All Ireland medals with Kerry teams. Yes, I might know about that. No, I don't think so. I think I'm quite an open book, really. I can't think really of anything that.
And you're, in a way, you've put your life on record via your job, it's kind of interesting. And what about yourself?
I like knitting. Maybe people might be surprised at that. I don't know.
So were a student passed by the window of your home?
No, I'm not sitting there knitting at the moment. But we actually did have a knitting club for a short while in Trinity. I think it is interesting. I mean, I suppose it's not that if you're involved in academia, and I don't think anyone listening should think that you have to personally tell everything about yourself all of the time. But there is something that comes with it, that your personal beliefs become part of it. So even though I was very involved in engineering and technology, I would say that my kind of feminist beliefs would come out through that and would work its way through it. Or my particular beliefs about power and about inclusion and exclusion would kind of work its way out. So to a certain extent, you as Mary said earlier, you have kind of a platform that you have the privilege of being able to express things. Now, obviously, you do it in an evidence-based way, and you do it based on, you know, on the kind of methodologies and research techniques that you grow to master. But it is a platform that allows you, to a certain extent, if you so choose, to be able to express a lot about yourself, I think.
Yeah.
On another point, are you both good at saying no?
No.
Yeah, I'm desperate at it. And like we couldn't say no to you, Nadine.
Yes, exactly. Every so often I think I really need to start saying no to things.
Yeah.
But no, I'm not very good at saying no.
And do you see that as a positive or negative?
I don't know, because, you know, a lot of the things I'm asked to do is you know, give public lectures, take part in public platforms, do things like this, which I enjoy. And, you know, I feel it's a real privilege to have a platform on which I can, you know, go on radio and talk about all sorts of things from feminism to politics to history. And not many people get that opportunity, or go on TV and take part in documentaries that I'm really interested in, or write in newspapers. So in many ways, I feel saying no would, you know, be the wrong thing to do. But it also does eat into your time. And particularly your time outside of your main job. So you're doing it as an extra, as an add-on. And so there can be times, I'm sure, I know probably, yeah. Absolutely, as provost, you're working 7 days a week and there is no shutting down.
But I think so. It's but it is. There's kind of a positive and a negative. So from a kind of, you know, management speak, the whole idea that you don't prioritize and you say yes to a lot of things can be, someone will say, OK, you need to think a bit more. But I also think, I think there are more opportunities for leadership than people who say yes to them. And by saying yes to things, you're kind of a mindset to say, yes, yes, I'll give that, you know, I'll try that. So I think there's kind of a balance to be gotten there. And I also think I end up sometimes saying yes to things without really thinking about it. And then this really amazing experience or something that you didn't ever expect happens. Mm-hmm. And you learn so much from that. And it actually serendipitously feeds back into the kind of yes. whatever challenges you're facing or whatever. So I think there's kind of a balance, yeah. in, you know, yeah. not being so kind of, I suppose, not being so clinical in your prioritization and being able to say yes, I think leads to lots of kind of adventures, I suppose.
True.
Oh, it certainly does. Yes, mm. I've enjoyed those adventures. So it's
like this
it's
podcast good. One day, yeah, exactly. one might say.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
You know, you're both so successful. Was there a moment, is there any moment that you can think of where you just looked at yourself in the mirror and thought, I've made it. This is it. This is the high point. Is there anything like that?
Well, I hope it isn't the high point. I've still a lot of years to go. You know, I'm not president of any university yet. So.
Yes.
but no, I don't.
So there wasn't even like getting your degree, you know, your PhD.
Oh, yeah,
or
like the day of the conferring. That was all great. And having your parents there and taking the photographs and, you know, or wearing the gown and whatnot. That's fantastic. And there are moments you don't forget. And there are moments, you know, publishing your first book and first articles and going on TV for the first time. That was terrifying. and my mother on the phone, I hope you're wearing something nice. I'm not a fashionista. But no, I don't. I hope there are many more high points to come and many more adventures and journeys to go on before I retire. But even in retirement, I've already planned for the books I'm going to write when I retire. So,
God, Mary, you're very organized.
Love your mind. And Linda, finally to yourself.
I would say I hope there's many more things to come. But the day that I did get elected, I have to say was very, very special. And you did really feel like you were floating. It was, of course, during COVID, so our election happened remotely. But I was able to be on campus and there was only a certain number of people allowed. And when I came into Front Square, and you know, people were around, it is a moment I will forever treasure. And some of my family were there, and it was just like you just do feel like you were floating. Yeah. So I hope there's other moments like that, but it was pretty amazing.
Well, Linda Doyle and Mary McAuliffe, thank you so much for your contribution to How I Did It.
Thank you very much.
Now, Mary McAuliffe is staying with us on How I Did It, and I'm delighted to say that I am joined now also on the line by Lorraine Murphy, management consultant and executive coach who's worked across the public and private sectors. Lorraine, you're very welcome to the podcast. How are you?
I'm really good. Thank you for having me.
Now, the subject that you're in to discuss on the podcast today is networking, how to do it, how to be good at it, and how to get your message across, or sometimes even just how to become known to other people. It has been a particular challenge over the past 2 years, particularly for younger people, to make their presence felt. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And networking, it's the single most effective marketing tool that people can use, you know, if you want to grow your business, and especially, as you said, from early on in the business, getting yourself out there, getting known, building up relationships with people. And I know a lot has been happening online, which is fantastic. And a lot of the organizations were quick to move everything online to still be able to provide platforms for people to be able to network. But getting out there, shaking hands with people, sitting down, having a cup of coffee, you can't beat it. So I'm delighted to see that people will be able to get back into doing that again.
What particular tips would you give younger people as we move out of restrictions and into a freer world?
Okay, so I think the big thing is it's taking that jump now from moving out from behind the laptop, behind the screen, and getting out there in front of people. And you cannot underestimate the importance of it. Networking is about building relationships, mutually beneficial relationships with other people. And you really need to work at it. It's something that, you know, you work one person at a time. What we have to do is find people that we can find common ground with and factor networking into your working week or your working month. It's not something you might need to do every week, but you have to allocate time to networking as part of your business. And to look at it as it's not just going out to meet people or it's not a social event. It's really about this is time that you're still on the clock, you're working, and that you need to focus your time into doing that. So by doing that, it helps that we ring fence time to make sure we're going to allocate time to networking. We're going to be selective as to where we're going to network, the networking groups we're going to go into, and have a purpose and a reason for going in there. Why am I going into that room? Who do I want to speak to? What do I want to get out of it before I go into that room? And it's really important that you put that value on the time that you're going to spend networking.
Are there particular groups that you'd recommend to people, whether it's, you know, women in business networking groups or Network Ireland?
So, yes. So basically, and I found for myself, when I started out originally, like I put years and a lot of time into networking, and it is thanks to that that it's gotten me to where I am today. But when I started out, I was working and supporting a lot of women who are at the early stages of starting up their businesses. So, you know, I was working with women in business through the local LEOs, the local enterprise offices, and as a mentor and doing different work with smaller businesses that were starting out. And I realized that within a small radius, and I'm based out in Slane in County Meath, and between Drogheda, Slane, all those areas around, there were so many individuals, especially females, who were at home at the kitchen table trying to start up a business on their own and trying to do everything on their own. And it was a no-brainer for me to say, right, we need a platform to bring all these women together. So, you know, went to a hotel and said, can I get a room that I can just invite all these people to come in together and speak to them and say, look, you're all trying to run a business yourselves, but you'll get there a lot quicker if you support each other. So we set up a local networking group that started with that, which was very beneficial to a lot of women in the area. And they found it a lot easier to come into a room where it was women only and being able to talk about the struggles of juggling everything, the guilt they were feeling about, you know, trying to allocate time to their business, but they want to be at home. Is, you know, how do I get it to the next level? Accounts, getting details of a good accountant, marketing, media, all those things. And we were able to share and support each other in a space that was specifically to women starting out in business.
You mentioned you're living in Slane. A lot of people during the pandemic will have moved out of city centres and relocated to rural areas where they're still very effectively doing their jobs, but may fear that they are going to be at a disadvantage when it comes to promotion and opportunities in years going forward. There's a lot of people currently that are working technically within an organisation, but living miles away from the organization.
Yeah.
So networking, even within your own company, becomes something that you have to actively consider.
It is. And I would say, so there's a couple of things to take into consideration there. When working for your company, you can be a massive valuable asset remotely by joining into a local networking group. So if we have all of our employees living in the area that the company is based in. No one outside of that region or area is networking with our employees. So actually, there's a benefit to people who are working remotely and who can represent their organisation in a different region and in a different regional networking group. And we'd also see it as well through a lot of the remote working initiatives that are out there, and there's, you know, massive investment into local enterprise hubs where people can go and work, even if they go one day a week and base themselves there. They will be networking with other people who are working for different companies. So you're still connecting with other businesses. You're keeping yourself out there. You're not hidden away completely. So actually, I think there's a lot of advantages in spreading our employees out into various different regional areas who could represent our organisations on a broader scale, rather than everyone being condensed into a round where the business actually operates. So there's a lot of advantages to that.
I love the way you've really gracefully turned the situation into an absolute humdinger of a, look at me, I am somewhere else in the country representing this company and doing them proud. It's a lovely way to put it, and a lovely way actually, I think, for employers to reconsider, because obviously there's a lot of insecurity and fear around new working arrangements. So, you know, to sum up, if you could say to people, you know, five key things to bear in mind, or a couple of key things to bear in mind, and because often it is about mindset, what would you advise?
So what I would say is, see it as part of your business. Definitely, it's a massive part of helping your business to grow. So before going out, it's not about you. It's about building relationships with other people. So don't go in trying to sell your business. And that's where people get really worried. And we don't want someone selling. I don't want to go into a room and someone starts selling things to me. So we want to just go in and have a chat, one person at a time. You're not going in to speak to a whole room of people in one go. Just see it as, even if I get to speak to two people, that's plenty. A good place to base yourself, and that's why I find as well in real life networking, it's easier, go straight to where the coffee is. That's where people will start to chit chat. You know, say, would you like a coffee? I'm pouring one for myself here. You've started a conversation. It's as simple as that.
Pass
it's about talking. It's about, exactly. Yes. Do you take sugar? You know, and then we build in. So where have you traveled from? And it eases into a natural, you know, it's like the party happens in the kitchen, get the coffee area. And that's where you get chatting to new people.
Yeah. Well, speaking of listening, Mary, yes. To bring you in on networking, are you a good networker?
I am now. I used to be. I had to train myself into that, because actually it's, you know, when you asked her, there's something people don't know about you. I'm actually kind of shy. And so I had to force myself to become a networker. And I eased into it. And I suppose for somebody like me, networking happens in conferences and book launches and public lectures and things like that. But it's as important in academia as it is in business, in that you have to build up these relationships. And you're very right. It is about talking. In terms of book launches, you go to where the wine is being poured and where the cheese is going round, and having a chat with people and know, what are you doing and what are you working on now? And because, of course, we do in academia, we do a lot of collaborative research, particularly when it's going for research funding and things like that. So the pandemic has really shut down a lot of that, and now we need to get back to that. And actually, I realised I missed it. I missed, because actually the book launches had become my social life, which is a bit nerdy. But it is that space where you can meet colleagues and chat and talk, because you can be very isolated in your own office. But I think you're very right. It is about conversations and listening, and not just selling yourself and, oh, I'm the big hoo-ha or whatever, but about those collaborative conversations, just gently chatting about what you're doing and having a good time while doing it as well.
Well, I'm going to take these life lessons and apply them ferociously down the line for my networking in the future. But for now, Lorraine Murphy and Mary McAuliffe, thank you so much to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How I Did It, the Business Post's Women in Leadership podcast.
And my thanks once again to all of our contributors, Linda Doyle, Trinity Provost, Mary McAuliffe, historian and director of the Gender Studies Programme at UCD, and Lorraine Murphy, executive coach. Coming up in the podcast next week,
I'll be talking to Frances Fitzgerald, the former Taoiseach who's been an MEP for Dublin since 2019. She'll be joining us next Sunday alongside Joan Burton, also a former Taoiseach. Joan Burton was Minister for Social Protection from 2011 to 2016 and a TD for Dublin West for over two decades. Plus, we'll have advice for you on the art of public speaking. I think it'll be a fascinating discussion, and I hope you can join us. How I Did It is co-produced by myself and Catherine Healy. Remember, you can find our podcast episodes on the Business Post website, businesspost.ie/podcast, and you can also find us via Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and more. And if you're on those podcast platforms, do consider hitting that subscribe button as well, so you'll be auto-notified when the next episode of How I Did It appears. If you'd like to get in touch with the podcast, you can do so over Twitter. My Twitter handle is @NadineO'Regan. And you can also drop me an email, nadine@businesspost.ie. Right, thank you so much for listening. Till the next time, do take care.
How I Did It, the Business Post Women in Leadership podcast with Nadine O'Regan.
Sponsored by Glandor, creating space for business to grow.